There's just something about birds, isn't there? You see a hawk up there making lazy circles in the sky, or a hummingbird outside your window, and man, it can just make your day. And that's why you should be concerned with what you're about to hear. Welcome. Thanks for being a part of the full story on WSHU and online at WSHU.org. I'm Ron Ropiak, and the topic today is pretty straightforward. The bird population in North America is down. It's way down. Climate change is a huge threat going forward, and many are worried. Now, we have a number of experts joining us today, and your comments are always welcome. You can find us on Facebook at Full Story WSHU. But if you don't use Facebook and you'd like to send us your thoughts, the best way to do that is by email. And that email address is tfs@wshu.org. I have two guests with me for the next few minutes to talk about the latest reports. Anna Paula Tavares is Executive Director for Audubon New York and Audubon Connecticut. Anna, welcome. It's a pleasure to have you on.
Thank you, Ron, and thank you so much for your interest in hearing about our science.
Corey Folsom O'Keefe is Audubon Connecticut Director of Bird Conservation. Corey, nice to meet you. Thanks for coming on.
Glad to be here.
These reports are not good. There's no other way that I could say it. Anna, can you tell us about them, please?
Sure. So Audubon, National Audubon Society scientists came out with a new science report that shows that 2/3 of North American bird species, 389 out of 604 that we studied, are at risk of extinction from climate change. The good news is that our science also shows that if we take action now, we can help improve the chances for 76% of species at risk.
Can an average Joe, someone like me, actually see this happening right now? And Corey, I ask that because I've noticed over the last year or two that I go out onto my yard and I actually see a lot more hawks and owls and turkey vultures, believe it or not. That's in my neck of the woods. Can we see the decline happening?
Well, I think you can definitely see birds shifting. Some species that I've noticed is when I was doing my master's degree research back in 2006 and 2007, finding a blue-gray gnatcatcher was kind of a rarity, and now they seem to be everywhere in Connecticut. Similar species that also seem to be sort of shifting their range are the hooded warbler. That's a species that's typically more to our south, and that's one that seems to be shifting in Connecticut. The report also indicates that a bird called the yellow-breasted chat is another species that is typically more found to our south, but is sort of shifting into Connecticut. What I'm noticing is sort of new species kind of moving into the state, but we're also losing species. So the white-throated sparrow is an example, dark-eyed junco. These are species that used to breed in the northern section of the state, but now it's much harder to find them breeding in those areas. They're breeding more to the north at this point.
Anna, not to get too deep into the science, why is this happening? Why are the birds dying or going to other places?
So we're facing really unprecedented changes in patterns of temperature, precipitation. So this study also looked at a multiple global scale threats related to climate change. So it's not just the temperature change, but it's sea level rise, Great Lakes level changes, human land use changes such as cropland expansion, urbanization, extreme weather events such as heat waves, droughts, heavy rain, false spring, fires. So we're seeing all of this. And so with these changes, birds are losing their habitat, food, shelter, and they're getting confused. And climate change, as shown by this report, is the number one threat to birds at this time.
And just to be clear about this, the birds are actually dying, or are they simply going to other places?
Well, there are a number of issues, right? So there are the birds that are resident to a region, and there are the migrating birds. So there are issues, so let's say with sea level rise, one of the birds at very high risk of extinction in Connecticut and in New York on our coast is the beautiful piping plover. Piping plovers with sea level rise are threatened to lose bird reproduction during nesting season because their nests get flooded. But if you think of the case also of piping plovers, they migrate south to the Bahamas. And with the kinds of very strong storms that we are seeing all over, but recently in Bahamas, they are at high risk of losing their winter habitats as well.
Now
so it's a multitude of events. All not good at all for birds, but as we all know, birds not only bring joy and beauty to our lives, birds are also very important indicators of the health of an ecosystem. So obviously this is also quite concerning for other wildlife and people as well.
So, Anna, those piping plovers that you were mentioning, those are those beautiful small birds that we see when we go to the beach, right?
Exactly. They're hard to spot along the beach because you can't, with well camouflaged feathers, it's really hard to see them. But that makes it even extra special when you see one of them. And they are amazing. So they look like a cotton ball on toothpicks.
Hmm.
And they're amazing. The newly hatched plover chicks weigh about 6 grams, but they can walk and forage within hours of hatching. So very precocious little chicks.
I love that description, a little cotton ball. That says it all right there. Corey, one researcher said that this report is the canary in the coal mine, which caught my eye, and the Earth is obviously the coal mine. Is that an apt description?
I think so. I mean, climate, birds shifting their populations, and one of the reasons why the birds are sort of so threatened by climate change is, birds are sort of used to nesting in a particular climatic conditions, temperatures, humidity, and with climate change, where those particular characteristics are different places. So they're kind of going to new areas, will there be habitat for them that's appropriate in those new areas? We don't know the answer to that question. So that's kind of why this is such a big issue. The threats that are facing birds, just sort of shifting their ranges. Other climate-related things like sea level rise and more intense and more frequent storms, those also impact people. And if we just think about our coastal communities, birds might be losing habitat along the coast because of sea level rise, increased storm frequency and intensity. But that's also going to be threatening people who live along the coast, too. So it really has the potential to have huge impacts, not just on the birds, but on the people along our coastline and across our state as well.
Anna, you know that there are many who still believe that climate change is not happening and that this is just a natural occurrence and that some of what is being reported is just being exaggerated in their opinion. What do you think when you hear that?
Ron, I think that politics aside, let's just think whether it's man-made or not. It's here. The planet is not negotiating. We need to do something about it, and we need to do something about now. And we're not looking for Band-Aids. We need transformational, significant changes. And the cool thing is that we can. We can change these negative trends, and we have a window of opportunity. So these studies were all based on UN, the Intergovernmental panel on climate change. They are 800 scientists from 80 countries projected what would happen at warming at 1.5 degrees, 2 degrees Celsius, and 3 degrees Celsius. So this is all based on that, plus 140 million bird records and observational data that we plugged with this UN model. And this is real. This is real. This is important information that we need to pay attention to. And it's exciting to see that the 1.5% warming is imminent. If we do nothing, if we continue with business as usual, we're going to get to 3% by 2080 or so. As an average for Connecticut, it's even higher than that.
Anna, I'm going to pause you right there because I have to take a short break. When we come back, I would love for you to tell us about some of the transformational significant changes that you think that we should make and what the average person can do actually right now to make some of those changes. Two guests continue with us for the next few minutes. Corey Folsom O'Keefe is the Audubon Connecticut Director of Bird Conservation, and Anna Paula Tavares is Executive Director for Audubon New York and Audubon Connecticut. And I'm going to pick it up with you again because you said, you know, we can make a change right now. It doesn't have to be as bad as some are saying it might be, and you talked about transformational significant changes. What needs to be done?
Well, to begin with, Ron, I would highly recommend that you and all those listening go to our website and type your zip code, and you will be able to see it using our climate visualizer, a really cool tool. You'll be able to see what's happening at your neighborhood and your backyard. So you'll be able to see of those climate-related threats, which ones will impact your region, but you also be able to see at the 1.5, 2 and 3 degrees Celsius warming, what's going to happen to your birds in your backyard. That hopefully will inspire you to act. And one way, so we need to mitigate climate. There are things that we need to do to reverse this change. And that means what are the things that we can do to reduce carbon emissions? But also we need to adapt because some of these changes are already happening and will continue to happen. So we must voice support for clean energy. So here in Connecticut and in New York, change is on the horizon. We must support the development of responsibly sited and operated renewable and clean energy, such as wind and solar. And we really need to act as volunteers. We need to vote. We need to voice and ask our elected officials at the local, state, and federal level for climate solutions. We also need to work to protect our forests and improve the health of our forests, because our forest birds are some of the most at risk, as well as our coastal birds. So protecting, enhancing, restoring wetlands, marshes at our coast is extremely important, and everyone can take actions in your own way. Again, as volunteers, as voters, as advocates, and we need to do it. We need to do it now. The time is now, and we need bold actions.
Corey, what about something that the average person can do in the next few days? You know, I'm thinking about bird feeders. I know a number of people in my area have simply said, look, no more pesticides, no more fertilizers. Let things grow naturally. Let nature take its way, and that will bring the birds back and the good insects, the ones that we want to have around. What about things like that?
Absolutely. You know, so the climate report tells us that our birds are going to be sort of shifting their range. And one way that everybody in their own backyard can help birds do that is to make sure that there's, you know, a wealth of sort of food available. And the way to do that is to plant native plants. So native plants are going to host a whole variety of insects and birds, actually, during the breeding season. They're one of their primary food source is insects. You know, I think there's a study out there that showed that 95% of what a robin feeds its young in the spring is insects, you know, worms and other insects. So having native plants that support native insects, you're basically providing bird food. And if those native plants also produce berries or seeds, that's another way you can be providing bird food. So you can have a bird feeder out, but if you plant native plants, that's another way of doing that. And I literally saw that in my backyard yesterday. I had a dogwood, a Florida dogwood, which is native to Connecticut, that was in fruit, and a whole flock of cedar waxwings came in and were sort of foraging on it.
Hmm.
So you really can provide habitat or improve the habitat for birds in your yard by planting native plants. And then also sort of think about when you can, you know, if you're going somewhere that's a half mile from your house, budget yourself a little bit more time and see if you can walk there. So that's another simple way that people can sort of be helping to reduce their carbon footprint, you know, to benefit birds.
You know, you're making me smile because since I know a few times a year, flocks of birds will show up in my yard, and it's fantastic when they all show up. And it's just a thrill to see as they circle and they come in. Anna, you mentioned before about the shoreline, and obviously in this country, a good chunk of the population lives within X number of miles from the coastline. Talk to us a little bit more about the impact that this is having on the birds specifically for the coastline.
Well, if you think birds are being squeezed by development from one end, sea level rise, and very powerful storms from the other end, right? And there are infrastructure solutions, but we are really encouraging and urging government officials and local populations, landowners, to think about natural solutions. One of our priorities moving forward over the next few years in Long Island and Long Island Sound is to really help to enhance, restore, protect salt marsh habitat. So between New York and Connecticut, there are about 40,000 acres. These are really important. Our coasts are very important for public safety, for economic reasons, as well as environmental reasons. By protecting salt marsh, for example, we can protect not only fisheries and nesting birds and birds that depend on those habitats, but also our local communities. And these create buffers that take on the energy of these storms and really absorb some of the water, avoiding floods and so on.
Hmm. Corey, I have about 2 minutes left. With that time, could we talk a little bit about how this impacts us when it comes to certain diseases? Because, you know, being in Connecticut, we all know what's been taking place with viruses from mosquitoes, West Nile virus and Eastern equine encephalitis. Tell us how birds help to keep that under control.
Well, birds eat insects, so, you know, they definitely can help to keep our insect populations at bay. You know, one species is the chimney swift, and some of our other aerial insectivores like tree swallows and barn swallows. You know, they're flying around right at dusk, right when all the mosquitoes are out, and, you know, can kind of help keep those insect populations under control. And, you know, so the more birds we have, and we got some insect control there, and, you know, definitely Not something that we talk about in our report, but you know, with warmer temperatures, you know, the mosquito season lasts longer into the fall and starts up earlier in the spring. So, you know, definitely more possibility for, you know, mosquito-borne illnesses in the future. So having lots of birds around to be able to help eat those mosquitoes is a very good thing.
Anna, I have 1 minute left. Final thoughts, please.
We can. We must. The time is now. We have the information. We have the means. We know what to do. We just need the will and the action. So let's do it. Together, we can meet this challenge.
Anna Paula Tavares is Executive Director for Audubon New York and Audubon Connecticut, and Corey Folsom O'Keefe is Audubon Connecticut Director of Bird Conservation. Corey, Anna, thank you. I appreciate your time. Please come back with us in the future.
Wonderful. Thank you, Ron.
Thank you.
You're welcome. Thanks, Ron.
Appreciate it. It's the full story on WSHU, and we are continuing the conversation about birds and the reports that detail the decline in the population. So the question for you is, what are you seeing around here? When you go to the beach, what are you seeing? There are fewer birds around there? What about in your backyard, at your bird feeder or the bird bath? Are some species gone? Or are they just fewer in number? And are you seeing others that you haven't seen before? You can email us, tfs@wshu.org. We're on Facebook at Full Story WSHU, and we have a number of guests who are going to join us for the rest of the program. Now, to round out this segment, Aaron Virgin is going to speak with us. Aaron is an environmental analyst. He's at Group for the East End, and Aaron studies ospreys. Hey, Aaron, how are you?
Hey, Ron. Always a pleasure.
It's great of you to come on. We always appreciate it. Aaron, when you see the latest reports, what do you think?
Well, you know, it's a little crazy in that we're talking about two-thirds of the birds that, you know, we see coming through our areas. It's a little daunting, but, you know, prior to working at the group, I worked for Audubon, and one of the first State of the Birds reports that came out about 15 years ago was kind of telling the same story. Mm. And we really haven't done much. As a society, our government at the federal level for sure hasn't. And so I'm not too shocked by this. What's happened between the first State of the Birds report and this most recent report is we have more people out in the field, people utilizing a program called eBird, which is a collaborative between Cornell Lab of Ornithology and the National Audubon Society. And in the last, I'd say, 5 years, the scientists who wrote this report you've been talking about has been able to mine a ton of information. And so what it really was able to do is put a spotlight on these declines. And as we've all known, we've all been seeing, reading different reports and just watching the news, climate change is real. And for folks that still deny it's not real, that's a real problem. And just to interject one thing Anna said, and I agree with her 100%, we need to keep our elected officials accountable. And one of the biggest things we can do, and this is coming up November 5th, is vote. And if there's someone that's not believing in climate change or not taking the right action, that's probably someone you don't want to vote for.
Aaron, you were mentioning that you and others were talking about this 15 years ago. And you know, we've used the phrase canary in the coal mine. And basically back then, you were the canary in the coal mine. You said, this is coming. Watch out.
Well, I'll go back even further. I was just reading an article yesterday that 1969, a group of scientists, which would have been either EPA scientists or federal scientists, either way, biologists, went to Lyndon Johnson and said, there's signs that there's something going on here. There's something going on. There's, you know, and it had to do with carbon emissions, of course, and there's something going on. And that was one of the first times that this occurred, that people were saying, they're talking at the federal level, that this was a real thing. And yes, it does get politicized. I've had debates on Facebook with friends and how it's a political issue. You know, you can say, you know, Al Gore is on the side of the politics, he's on the side of the science. But the issue is, there is science out there that shows that this is happening. So, but again, this report that just came out, this great report that Audubon put together, And if you look at the scientists and read their backgrounds who put this together, it is powerful. And this science is black and white. There's no arguing over whether this is real or not.
Mm. Aaron, you study ospreys.
Yes.
Are you seeing any effect on them specifically right now?
Well, to pivot a little bit, the osprey, both in, I don't want to speak for Connecticut, but I've read their most recent report, and it's very similar to what we've seen on the East End. There's been a population increase, and this is another thing that's interesting. The scientist Carl Safina wrote a great piece earlier in the week about how wildlife needs us just as much as we need wildlife. And what he meant by that is, and this is true with the osprey, without putting up those platforms for them to nest on, when they started to come back after DDT was banned, they needed us. They needed us to help build that population back. They've needed us when our fish populations were depleted to change the fisheries regulations. They've needed us when the water became too polluted in certain areas. And so with that, we've actually had, and when I was on earlier in the year, we talked about how they've almost become problematic, nesting on utility poles. Hmm. We've seen the reemergence of bald eagles, right? And for the same reasons. They're coming back. They're nesting on osprey poles. They're obtaining fish that are there that maybe had declined in decades ago. So, yes, we are seeing positive populations of different birds as well.
And I think you and I talked about this in the past. If an osprey is in the nest and if they're protecting the young'uns, don't get too close.
Absolutely. You had a great story.
Stay away. So we're seeing, because I think this is where some people may get confused, because some people will see birds like bald eagles and ospreys, and maybe some others, like the owl that was in my backyard last winter and turkey vultures around me and a few others. And they're saying, what are you talking about that birds are declining? Because we're seeing these birds that we haven't seen before, and they're thriving. What are you so worried about?
Well, absolutely. You point out a couple birds. You can say American robin. You can say yellow-rumped warbler, chipping sparrow. There's birds that are like generalists, all right? They can nest in a variety of habitats, from a backyard to a forested area. They might not migrate as much. They change their food. They don't maybe rely on just insects or see a certain fruit. So the American Bird Conservancy has done a great job with tracking different species, both that are declining, that are maybe a handful left in the world, and then others that are actually increasing, things like the yellow-rumped warbler and some other things like mallard duck is slightly increasing. You gotta dig down into the details, though, because some people will politicize that and say, oh, I've seen a lot of birds in my backyard, or I've seen a lot of birds when I've gone on trips. We're losing the specialists. We're losing things like piping plover that Anna and Corey brought up before. I mean, when you start losing habitat, when you start losing these keystone species, as we call them, they're representing the loss of something, like a salt marsh. We are seeing the loss of species that depend on certain things. And that's, again, flipping it back to us. That's where they need us just as much as we need them.
In the studio with me is Pat Cummins. Pat is executive director of the Connecticut Audubon Society. How are you, Patrick?
Great. It's a beautiful day.
It's a beautiful day. Thank you for coming in. I appreciate you driving in.
You're welcome.
Jillian Liner is also joining us. Jillian is director of bird conservation for New York Audubon. Hi, Jillian.
Hello. Great to be here.
Thanks for coming on. And Jillian, I want to start with you. Your reaction to the report that your organization, Audubon, put out.
It's a very important report that highlights the threat of climate change, which many of us are aware of, but it reinforces some of the conservation efforts that we're taking now and also brings some attention to the threat in the future and some of the birds that might not be on our radar yet.
Pat, just to go back to what Aaron was saying a few minutes ago, I know this is the latest report, and I know it's shocking, and I know it's bad. But at the same time, is this anything that was unexpected? Because, you know, it's like Aaron was saying, you guys probably knew about this 15, 20 years ago and tried to put the warning signs up back then.
I think some of the scope surprised us. Some of the range changes have just been remarkable, and over the next coming decades, we're going to be seeing a lot of birds that are common in our state now moving northwards and moving out of our state, and additional birds that we're not familiar with moving northwards, which we've actually been seeing going on for decades. Species like cardinals, tufted titmice, northern mockingbirds, blue-gray gnatcatcher, Carolina wren, turkey vultures, black vultures, they were either unheard of or very rare in Connecticut, you know, in the middle of the 20th century. Today, there are common familiar birds. 50 years from now, we may have an entirely different suite. Unfortunately, some of the birds are not going to be able to adapt, and we're just going to lose them altogether. And I think that's the shocking part.
You and I were sitting here talking before, and I sat down and I thought about it, and over the last year or so, in my neck of the woods, I'm getting turkey vultures, I'm getting owls, and at the same time, when I thought about it, this year the cardinals and blue jays have just not been around at all where they were in the past. Plus, I got hummingbirds in this spring, which I haven't gotten in the past. Things have changed rapidly.
Yeah, things are always changing. But there was actually a recent study by Cornell that estimated there are 3 billion fewer birds in North America than there were in 1970. And from a variety of causes, habitat loss and degradation being the chief one. But climate change is really an overarching threat, and it's impacting the habitats. So it's accelerating the problems that the birds already have.
Jillian, I'm going to ask you and Aaron for practical advice now. If someone is listening at home or in the car in a podcast or whatever, and they're saying, okay, what can I do to help this situation? Is there something I can do or buy this weekend that would help the bird population in my region? What would you suggest?
Yeah, one thing is just reducing your own energy consumption, and also making sure you're an advocate for policies that help address climate change. So becoming more educated and informed on what policies are out there and what you can do at the local, state, or federal level. But certainly there's things that you can do in your home, like reducing, you know, your energy consumption, planting natives, and steps like that.
And Aaron, you know what? I should mention that I went on your Instagram page before we went on the air, and you have a nice little page, and it's simply entitled 7 Simple Actions to Help Birds. Could you run down the 7 actions for us?
Sure. Well, I mean, Jillian said one of them, and that's what I was going to kind of discuss in length a little bit, and that is plant natives. Go to your local nursery. The fall is the best time to plant. Go to your local nursery, look online, what grows in your area. What are you looking to attract to your area? Some people like to plant things for birds and butterflies and other pollinators. That's a big one. You know, reducing your consumption of water is another one. On Long Island, our water is precious. It's at below our feet. We don't have a magic pipe coming from the Catskills. You know, reducing, obviously, like Jillian said, reducing your carbon footprint. I drive a hybrid Prius. And we are now working with a group called Project Drawdown, which looks at 100 different things that you can do in your daily life on the local level, not so much the macro level, and just things you can do that are simple things. You know, buying local produce, you know, giving up tropical fruit sounds like an extreme to some people, but think about the carbon emissions to get those bananas or mangoes to your supermarket. So those are some of the things. I'm sorry I'm not covering all 7. I'm out in the field at the moment.
I hit you with this one by surprise, and I apologize about that. But one of them at the top of it, which I found very interesting, is you had something in there that said,
Make windows safer, absolutely. And someone just sent me a picture of a gray horned owl caught in the Halloween stuff they put across the window to make it look like a spider web. It was a gray horned owl. The story is a good one because it was able to get out and it was able to, you know, return to its natural surroundings. But, you know, people often want the cleanest, beautiful window, and bird strikes are a horrific thing that happens not only in our homes, but I think it's the Minnesota Vikings. They built a structure that I think Audubon may have even, I know they had an issue with. I don't know if it was litigated or not, but the Minnesota Vikings built this beautiful glass and steel structure, and every year migrating birds are killed flying into it. So there are things that you know, on a larger scale, people don't even think about. But we need to kind of, you know, put a lot of energy and making these things change.
Pat, with one of the emails that we had a little bit earlier, and so I'd love to get your response to it, and this listener wrote in and said, I wonder if you could ask your guests about the lack of insects for birds to eat.
Yeah, that is a big issue because things like Chem Lawn, well, sorry to use a corporate name, but all these lawn services that are spraying pesticides onto our lawns. Those pesticides are not specific. They kill the good insects along with the bad insects. Mm. And the chemicals aren't necessarily the greatest things for your pets or your small children. But some of our aerial insectivores are really having a hard time. Our swallows, barn swallows, one of our common species, really declining throughout the Northeast. Chimney swifts, a species of global conservation concern now. And part of the concern is that they don't have the food supply that they need. All they eat are insects. And actually, even our inveterate seed eaters like cardinals and chickadees switch over to insects in the nesting season. So one of the things you can do is reduce your pesticide use. Try to eliminate it if at all possible. And also planting native plants, because our insects and our plants are co-evolved. They've grown up together, if you will, since the last ice age. Certain insects lay their eggs on certain species of vegetation. For example, more than 500 different species of butterflies and moths use oak trees as their larval food source. Whereas if you plant a non-native tree like a ginkgo, it's something like 3 to 4 species of butterflies and moths that might use that. So there are things that you can do to improve the beneficial insects, creating pollinator gardens. There's something called the Pollinators Pathways Program, which is starting particularly in Fairfield County, where they're trying to work with homeowners to improve the habitat for insects to sort of make a bridge between the protected spaces, the parks, the Audubon sanctuaries, so that we increase our numbers of beneficial insects. And some of those beneficial insects are actually predators of the insects that we don't want.
So in other words, they're in these protected areas, but if you start this, then maybe they will discover your lawn, your backyard, and then start to move into your area and help your lawn and help your wildlife.
Yes. You know, a lot of the wasps that will come into your pollinator garden are actually predators of some of the insects that are going to be damaging your vegetable gardens. So it's really sort of a form of integrated pest management to have a nice pollinator garden next to your vegetable garden.
How long has it been around? I haven't heard about this, and it sounds wonderful.
It's fairly new.
Okay.
It's been around about a couple of years now, but really starting to gain steam now. The town of Fairfield's really embraced it. There are signs that you can get to show that your yard's part of the pollinator pathways. They have all sorts of educational programs. The Connecticut Audubon Society, I actually just gave a talk Monday night up in Kensington, Connecticut, about landscaping for birds and other wildlife. I'm going around the state giving that talk.
I was
going
to say, it sounds very cool, and I'd love to get you back and do a longer segment on it.
I'd be happy to.
Jillian, I just want to talk about the, I don't know if you could call it the political aspect of it, because I heard what Aaron was saying and what Pat was saying, and I mean, let things go natural. But you look at some of the lawns around here and what people do with the outdoor areas of their houses, and I mean, look, some of the lawns look like golf course fairways, and obviously, I'm amazed that some of them don't glow at night. But how do you convince them, how do you convince people like that it's okay to have a bit more of a natural look?
Yeah, I think in part it's, you know, awareness that you can, and that native plants are beautiful and can be beautiful. I know with Audubon, our native plants program, we create demonstration sites. Our Theodore Roosevelt Center in Oyster Bay is actually undergoing a significant renovation, and a big focus of it is becoming a native garden demonstration site. So going and visiting places like that to see what these gardens look like, how they can take, they're easier to maintain, the benefits they have, like that Pat just mentioned, and then finding and connecting with local stores that actually sell those native plants. And I think people will realize they're beautiful. They bring in beautiful insects, but also butterflies, and they benefit the birds, and they're easy to maintain. And they start to realize, oh, this is doable. I can do this. And then other neighbors see other neighbors doing it, and hopefully it catches on more and more.
Aaron, when Anna was on with us at the beginning of the program, she was somewhat optimistic. She said, look, if we do the right things, we can make a change, and we could change this around for the better. Don't give up hope, and let's keep going. Are you optimistic? Do you think the changes can be made enough to especially help the birds?
I'm sorry, was that to me?
Yes.
Oh, absolutely. Going back to the osprey, we've done this. We can do this. All hope is not lost. Now, you know, the other side of that, though, is we seem to be going through a bottleneck. Elizabeth Colbert wrote a great book called The Sixth Extinction. And so there are some species on a grand scale we are losing. Not to jump over to Africa, but things like the rhinoceroses over there, black rhino. But that being said, we can't sit back and just let this become a reality. We need to step up. We need, and that's why I said November 5th is a big day. Vote for the people who can make the change. Vote for the people who are going to speak up, not only for people and humans, but for wildlife and for birds.
Pat, what is it about this story and about this report that you think that maybe is being underreported, that we're not highlighting enough?
Well, I think the hope is, I think that we have shown in the past we've faced threats to our civilization and really come together to address them and really pulled off miraculous victories, if you will. If you look back on World War II, it was amazing that we were able to mm-hmm. defeat the evil we were facing. I have a lot of hope that we can make the changes necessary to save this planet. And I think one of the most important things, as Jillian had said, is to get active, to contact your elected officials. Connecticut Audubon Society actually has a very useful tool where you can learn about opportunities to connect with your legislators and make it really easy with a few clicks to write to them and say, oh, this is an issue that's very important to me. And there are actually several pieces of legislation pending right now that I think will help situation. One is called Recovering America's Wildlife Act, which would actually dramatically increase the amount of funding that goes to the conservation of birds and other wildlife, and the money goes directly to the states who know best how to spend it in their local area. Mm-hmm. And another one is called the Land and Water Conservation Permanent Funding Act, and would actually increase the amount of funding necessary for land protection nationwide. And protecting land is a great way to sequester carbon. And it also means that if you're not developing the land, it's not going to go from a carbon sink to a carbon source. Mm. And the third one is actually related to osprey. We have a program called Osprey Nation, and we've found that in eastern Connecticut that there was a problem with osprey reproduction this year. They had very low productivity, and we think it may have been because of a lack of food. But there's a new pending piece of legislation called the Forage Fish Recovery Act, Forage Fish Restoration Act. And this is something that Audubon is, National Audubon Society is really putting a lot of effort in trying to get passed. And it is to put in more scientific controls in the harvest of smaller fish that are important food for birds and commercially important fish and marine mammals and seals and the like, so that we preserve the bottom of the food chain for the ocean, so that we have more abundant fish to eat. The fishermen have more fish that they want to go out and catch, like bluefish and striped bass, and our osprey and our loons and our seabirds are going to have plenty of food as well.
Jillian, I have about 1 minute left, and with that time, would you mind talking to us a little bit about kids, youngsters nowadays? Are you finding more of them coming out and becoming bird lovers, and is it tied into their fear of their future concerning climate change?
I think that, I mean, kids get engaged in nature not necessarily because of fear, because it's a place that's inspiring and interesting, and it, you know, sparks their curiosity and they want to learn more. And so I think that the more opportunities that we can give them, and then we, climate change and climate curriculum, it's certainly something that is taking place in public programs and school programs, and so they're probably going to be more aware than Aaron, Pat, or I ever were when we were younger about the issue, and in a good position to do something about it. So So yeah, hopefully it's continuing the theme of hope, because like Pat said, I think there are reasons to be hopeful and that we can make a difference.
And Aaron, 20 seconds for last thoughts, please.
I agree with everything Jillian just said. Where I see the real change occur, and maybe it's just we've seen this, you know, since the 60s, is like you hit that college age and there's like this awakening. And so the college students and some high school students, they're really getting more active. And we have a local high school group now and former college students, graduates, forming this project Drawdown on the East End. And it's really, it's a nationwide effort, and it's really doing, it's really taking off.
Aaron Virgin, environmental analyst at Group for the East End. Jillian Liner, director of bird conservation for New York Audubon. Pat Cummins, executive director of the Connecticut Audubon Society. Thank you, Pat. Thank you, Jillian. Thank you, Aaron.
Thank you, Ron.
Thanks for having us.
Thanks, Ron.
It was a pleasure, and we'll get you guys back soon. If you would like to comment on today's program, you can email us. We're at tfs@wshu.org. Facebook, leave a comment there. Find us at Full Story WSHU. That's going to do it for our show today. Sabrina Garone's the engineer. Carrie Franks, the digital editor. Associate producers, Sabrina Garone, Roberta Rojas, Fatou Sangari. J.D. Allen is the producer. Terry Sheridan is our news director. I'm Ron Ropiak, and thanks to you for being part of the Full Story.